Do you want to hear about my really bad day? Well, you're going to have to hear about it, whether you want to or not, all right? It was 2 weeks ago on a Sunday evening. I was way up at my dad's house near Sheridan, and we watched the final game in the NBA championship where Toronto beat Golden State. It was a great game. Afterward, I said my goodbyes, went out to my car, and it wouldn't start. It was about 11 o'clock. It was raining like crazy, imagine that, and the battery was dead. Not to worry, I had some jumper cables, but it wouldn't take a jump start. The battery was so dead it had shut down the car's entire electronic system, which meant it would not recognize my key fob and even try to start. So I get on the phone and call David. He says, oh, I'll come get you, 50 minutes up, 50 minutes back. But my dad is absolutely insistent that he is going to drive me home, which sounds like a good idea until you know that my dad is 86 years old, doesn't see very well, especially at night, and is hard of hearing. But he is adamant that he is going to take me home in the pouring rain, in the dark. So not wanting him to feel like he's an invalid or something, I said, okay. We're coming across the top of 465 where the construction zone is. A few times I had to say, a little bit to the left, Dad, a little bit to the right, you know, to keep him in the lanes. But 50 minutes later, we get home, pull into the driveway, home at last, thank heavens, and then it hits me, wait a minute, how am I going to get into the house? Normally, I would get in the house by pushing a button on the ceiling of my car, which would open the garage door, and then I would go into the house through the unlocked door that adjoins the garage. I keep a spare key as a backup hidden in my car, which was all the way 50 minutes north up in Sheridan. So I'm thinking, oh, no. But I had a solution. I had my cell phone. David was inside the house. This shouldn't be a problem. I ring him on the phone. No answer. I ring him again. No answer. A third time, no answer. He had fallen asleep. He had taken out his hearing aids, taken his anti-seizure medicine, which makes him very drowsy, and drifted off to sleep. Let's just say Jesus better not come back when David is asleep, or he will be left behind. Gabriel's trumpet could not rouse him when he's in one of those sleeps. And so here I am. I get out of the car, pouring rain, still dressed in my suit, banging the door knocker as loud as I can. Lucy, our dog, is barking inside like crazy, and still David sleeps. So in one last desperate attempt, one last idea, I went around the back of the house slipping and sliding in the mud, the pouring rain, with the idea that I was going to kick in the back door to the garage. I tried once. No. Twice. No. Third time, I kicked it in. Now, I know you will find that hard to believe. I'm kind of short. I'm kind of skinny. But I warn you, this body is a lethal weapon. So finally I'm inside, and you would think that would be the end of it, but no. The next morning we get up, David drives me all the way back to Sheridan, 50 minutes, to meet the tow truck. But the tow truck guy can't get the car out of park because the electronic system is dead and he doesn't know how to release the emergency thing, nor do I. He abandons us. 3 hours later, another tow truck guy comes. He takes the console apart, finds the emergency lever. 30 minutes later, he's hauling the vehicle to Ford. I think, finally, now it's good. I get to the Ford place and they're completely out of rental vehicles. One thing after another, which I tell you about because it is a perfect reminder that life is constantly trying to provoke us, to get us to freak out and respond with overwhelming anger, frustration, panic, anxiety, or some combination thereof, like a radiator on a car that's overheating. Life is constantly trying to get us to boil over. Which brings us to guidepost number 8 in Brené Brown's best-selling book, The Gifts of Imperfection. By now you know each of these guideposts represents a different primary characteristic of people who are engaged in wholehearted living. Guidepost number 8 reminds us that people who are engaged in wholehearted living, who are thriving in life, cultivate calm and stillness by letting go of anxiety as a lifestyle. What does that mean? How can we do that? Let's start with a prayer. God, there are so many ways life can set us off. Trouble at work, an argument at home, car problems, money problems, problems with our health, a kid that gets in trouble, people who say terrible things about us, discrimination, racism, injustice, crazy politics. How are we supposed to hold it together? How are we supposed to be calm and still in the midst of all of that? Jesus, show us the way. We ask in your holy name. Amen. King Saul was carrying a lot of stress. Remember, Saul was Israel's first king. Before Saul, Israel was a loose confederation of tribes that Saul had now united under a monarchy. He was trying to keep these rival tribes together, even while fighting off powerful enemies from the outside. On top of that, the famous prophet who had been his chief supporter, who had anointed him king of Israel, had now turned on him and become his chief public critic. Meantime, a young warrior named David was becoming so famous that he threatened to displace Saul's son Jonathan as heir to the throne. So Saul was carrying a lot, overwhelming stress and anxiety, and it was beginning to affect him. He began to have what we today would call panic attacks, where he would close himself in his room and be paralyzed for long periods of time. Then everything came to a head. One night at dinner, he and his son Jonathan got into a terrible argument, and in a fit of fury, Saul picked up his javelin and hurled it at his son, narrowly missing him. Saul almost killed his own son, heir to the throne. And as such, he stands forever as a warning of what can happen to us if we don't manage our stress and anxiety. It builds, it builds, it builds until eventually it explodes in some form of negative emotion. Anger, despair, frustration, panic, anxiety. Eventually it all explodes in negative ways that create craziness and destructive behavior in our life. Just ask Brené Brown. She, in her own unique way, before she began her research on wholehearted people, was a form of King Saul. She was struggling to juggle impossible competing demands of being a mother, a wife, a university professor, and a successful author and public speaker who often had to travel. She says, "It became so bad that whenever I got really anxious and stressed out, I would actually get lightheaded and the room would start to spin. A couple times, I literally fell over. The dizziness was new. The anxiety was not. In many ways," she says, "anxiety was a constant in my life." But then she delved into this research on people who were living wholehearted lives and had an epiphany. She began to realize that these people who were thriving in life had as much anxiety in their lives as she did, but were responding to it in a fundamentally different way. She says they were committed to a way of living where anxiety was a reality, but not a lifestyle. They did this by cultivating calm and stillness. That's her two-part formula for letting go of anxiety as a lifestyle. Practicing calm and stillness. So let's look at both parts of this equation today, beginning with the concept of calmness. In Brené's terminology, calmness has to do with how we respond in the heat of the moment to provocative situations in life. Managing provocative situations in our life begin with, Brené says, the realization that we get to choose how to respond. I know it sounds a little bit simplistic, but she says we reach a real tipping point in our lives when we come to the internal realization that though I do not get to control what happens to me in life, I do get to choose how I respond. Suppose, for example, someone is going around and saying outrageous things about you. You have a choice. You can respond to that with rage or calmness. But Jeff, you may say, that person deserves to feel my rage. Yes, but you don't. Because you see, when we explode with some form of negative emotion, despair, anger, frustration, anxiety, it's like a volcano erupting. When a volcano erupts, we see the external explosion of lava, ash, smoke, and fire. But remember, to support that external display, it requires that the entire mountain and the surrounding ground be on fire and in a place of complete meltdown. This is what it looks like inside each one of us when we succumb to one of those destructive, negative emotions. In order to express rage, in order to express despair or anxiety meltdown, I literally have to set my insides on fire. Why would I ever do that to myself? I'm passionate about what we're talking about today because it's made such a difference in my own life. When I was younger, I was a very reactive person. I tended to be a hothead, and over the course of time, through bad experiences with that and under the influence of the teachings of Jesus, of the many, many things in my life that I do poorly in my discipleship, one of the things that I've gotten down through those difficult experiences is reactivity is counterproductive. A little over a year ago now, I was in my office on a Friday afternoon working on preparing the Going Deeper discussion questions for our Oasis groups for the next week. It's usually one of the last things I do at the end of the week as I'm trying to wrap things up and get out of the office. It normally takes me about 90 minutes to do that. I was 60 minutes into it, already had a first draft. It was coming together well when the computer went down. Not to worry, it's set on a timer to back things up, so I figured I could at least, once it came back on, access a recent draft and go forward from there. But when the computer came back on, there was no backup copy. Something had gone haywire in that system as well. Couldn't find it anywhere, so I went to Spencer, who's our IT genius here at Life Journey, and brought him in and said, see if you can find something. And he's looking around everywhere. We can't find a backup. I say to him after he's looked for like 10 minutes, I say, it's okay. If we can't find it, I'll just start over again. He finally, thank God, finds a backup that I'm able to work off of. But before he leaves the office, he said, how can you, these weren't his exact words, but how can you be so calm? He says, if this happened to me, I'd be bouncing off the ceiling. I'd be going nuts. And I remember thinking to myself, why would I choose to do that to myself? How would that help? I mean, if I was going to have to step back and recreate this whole document, I was going to need all the equanimity and all of the emotional energy in me just to do that. So why would I waste all of that energy on a negative emotional reaction that was not going to help anything? This can make such a difference in our life. It can keep us from wasting so much emotional energy in our life. So how can we do better? What did he say? Put it in the cloud. I'm practicing calm right now. Don't react. Don't react. Spencer's just trying to provoke you. How can we... That's a novel thought. It is in the cloud now, right? Yes? Yeah, you... Well, you told me you did that recently, so I think it is in the cloud now. In any event, how can we do better? Brené Brown says, I finally learned the value of bringing quiet to difficult situations. So now, she says, I try to be slow to respond in provocative situations and quick to think. Guess what? That is exactly what the Bible advises us to do. James 1:19, you must understand this, my beloved. Let everyone be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. Be slow to react. Be quick to ponder. Be slow to freak out. That's the advice of the Bible. And no surprise, it's also the example of Jesus. I've always been fascinated by how Jesus responded at his trial before Pontius Pilate. People were making all kinds of false, provocative, false accusations against him. Matthew chapter 27, verse 12 says, when Jesus was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he did not answer. Then Pilate said to him, do you not hear how many accusations they make against you? But Jesus gave him no answer, not to even a single charge, so that the governor was greatly amazed. My gut tells me that in that moment, Jesus understood that there was nothing he could say that was going to make a difference. So he was not going to let himself be sucked into that drama. He was going to preserve his quiet, his peace, his emotional energy for the ordeal that lay ahead of him. He wasn't going to waste it in a senseless reaction. And in this, as in all things, Jesus is our example. So, how can we be more like Jesus in those provocative situations? Brené Brown says, it's just like anything else in life. If you want to get good at something, you have to practice it. Practice being calm in the moment of provocation. Several years ago, there was a public service announcement that was running a lot on television. At the start of the PSA, you saw this couple that was in the midst of a furious argument. I mean, they were slamming doors in each other's face. They were shouting things like, I hate you. I don't want to talk to you. Mind your own business. And then they'd slam doors and they'd go through it again. And finally, near the end of the PSA, they lovingly join hands, walk out of the room as one says to the other, I think we're ready now. Then, in a voiceover, the PSA announcer says, talk to your kids about drugs. It won't be easy, but it might save their life. You see what those parents were doing? They knew that if they were about to talk to their teenager about drugs, their teenager was going to say some really provocative things. And so they were preparing themselves to be calm in the midst of the storm. Practice makes perfect. So when we're in the midst of one of those provocative moments, how can we practice the holy calm that Jesus models for us? Brené suggests several steps. Number one, when something provocative happens, count to 10. Sounds simplistic, but we've got to create that reaction buffer. So something provocative happens, pause for just a second. Number one. Number two, as you're counting to 10, she says, take a deep breath and relax. Step three, I've added, repeat your spiritual mantra. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Think about it. When you're really angry or really anxious, it's a symptom of the fact that you are feeling very vulnerable. You are feeling powerless in a situation. So the perfect antidote to anger or anxiety as we pause is to say, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And as we feel that power of Christ in us, it makes us less reactive. And then finally, number four, at that time or later, have a calm, honest conversation about the provocation. Practice calmness. But remember, this is only step one of two key steps to cultivating calm in our life. Step number two is stillness, and it is equally important. One of my all-time favorite episodes from Will and Grace is the one where Grace was anticipating a visit from her mother. Grace loves her mother, but her mother knows how to push all of her buttons. And so Grace was very anxious about this visit that she was going to get from her mother. And she's sitting in Will's apartment on the couch talking to Jack about this, explaining this to him. And Jack convinces Grace that what she needs to do to be ready for Bobby Adler, to be ready for her mother, is she needs to practice being calm. So Grace agrees to practice. She puts herself in a zen-like state of calm. And then Jack, as only he can do, transforms himself into Bobby Adler and begins to try to provoke Grace. Sit up straight, dear. Why are you slumping your shoulders? Are you wearing a bra? I love that blouse, dear, but the color doesn't look good on you. Honey, when are you going to do something with your hair? At first, Grace is very calm. But then she can take it no more, and she explodes, grabs Jack by the shoulders, shaking him back and forth. She shouts, "Shut up, old woman, or I'll kill you." Shocked, Jack says, "Grace Adler, you are out of control," and then dramatically exits. Grace's example reminds us that just waiting until we're in the heat of the moment to practice is probably not going to be sufficient. Brené Brown suggests that we back up before that and add a whole additional step. Remember, it's a two-part sequence. Calmness, she says, is what we practice in the heat of the moment when we're being provoked. But step number two takes place well before we get into the provocative moment. Step one, in the heat of the moment, practice being calm rather than reactive. Step two, beforehand, build a rhythm of stillness into your life. Practice stillness in your life. Brené says, "I wish I could tell you how much I resisted even hearing people describe stillness as an integral part of their wholehearted journey. From meditation and prayer to regular periods of quiet reflection and alone time, men and women engaged in wholehearted living spoke repeatedly about the necessity of quieting their bodies and minds as a way to feel less anxious and overwhelmed." Brené says, "When I began seeing this trend in my sociological research," she says, "I actually found myself in a state of panic," she says, "because in my mind," she says, "I associated stillness with meditation, and I associated meditation with Eastern meditation, the idea of emptying your mind." And she said, "The very thought of that kind of meditation made me anxious." She says, "Every time I have tried to practice that kind of meditation, I have felt like such an imposter." She says, "I spend all of my time thinking about stopping thinking about things." She says, "I'll start off and I'll say to myself, okay, I'm not thinking about anything. Okay, I'm not thinking about anything. Milk, diapers, laundry detergent. Stop! Not thinking. Not thinking. Oh, man, when's this going to be over?" Brené says, "That's how I felt when I tried to meditate. But then," she said, "I began to realize, as I talked to all these people, that stillness can take any of a variety of forms, and that the challenge is to find stillness practices that fit your personality." She said, "Stillness is not about focusing on nothingness. It's about creating a clearing. It's opening up an emotionally clutter-free space and allowing ourselves to feel, think, dream, and question." Guess what finally worked for King Saul? when he would have his panic attacks and close himself in his room, his servants recruited an expert musician, David, who would come into the room and quietly play his stringed instrument. And in the midst of that beautiful music, Saul would find the emotional clearing to regain his perspective. For some people, practicing stillness means music. For some, practicing stillness means prayer. For many of us, practicing stillness means what we do here together on a Sunday as we gather in this place and we shut out the crazy noise and busyness of life. For at least 1 hour, we create some space for key questions and reflection on our life. Stillness can take many forms. For some, it's a rocking chair on the porch while you watch the sunset or the rain quietly coming down in the middle of the summer. For some of us, it is meditation, either something like yoga or picking a passage of scripture and just dwelling on that for a while. For some, it's jogging. For some, it's taking a long drive with no radio, no electronics. For some, it's walking outdoors. Brené Brown says that's what works best for my personality. She says, I'm never more open and emotionally clutter-free than I'm when I'm walking alone outdoors. That's what I have found works best for me too. Every Monday, which is my day off, I take my dog Lucy on a Monday morning and we go out to the woods and we go for a long walk. Sometimes I'll pray, sometimes I'm just quiet, soaking in the quiet. And then when I get home, I turn off the television and the phone, and until mid-afternoon, as St. John of the Cross once said, my house now being completely still. Try it. Quiet. And as Monday morning unfolds, waves of quiet are filling a reservoir in my soul that will be a resource of peace I can draw on in provocative situations for the rest of the week. Each one of us needs to find ways of practicing stillness. You can be a monk without having to go to a monastery. You can weave into your week some kind of monastic silence. Picture it, a classic monastery, an old-fashioned monastery where the monks have taken a vow of complete silence, the only exception being at the end of each year, one brother chosen by lot gets to speak one sentence. At the end of the first year cycle, the lot falls on Brother Jonas. He stands up and has one sentence to speak, so he chooses his words carefully. The mashed potatoes served with the roast every Christmas day I find to be delightful. Another year passes. The lot falls on Brother Samuel, who stands up, glares at Brother Jonas and says, the mashed potatoes are lumpy and I positively despise them. Another year rolls round. The lot falls on Brother James. He stands up, glares at both of them, and says, I am so fed up with this constant bickering, I quit. Fortunately, I like that. You didn't. I did. Fortunately, you don't have to become a monk to weave silence into your life. How are you bringing quietude into your life? But beware. Brené Brown warns us that there can be something very scary about creating silence in our lives. She puts it this way. If we stop long enough to create a quiet emotional clearing, the truth of our lives will invariably catch up to us. All of that stuff that we've been drowning out with the noise in our life and our hectic busyness can suddenly come to the fore when we get quiet. Is my life meaningful? Am I happy? What am I running from? No, no, no. Somebody quick, turn on the TV. No, no, I'll get my phone. Somebody's probably trying to call me. And we try to tamp down. We try to keep those inner demons at bay. The great irony being, that is the very thing that's making us so anxious, that we have all of this unresolved, free-floating stuff just below the surface that we drown out with our busyness and the noise of our lives. Quiet. Peace. In our gospel story today, Jesus gets off a boat on a remote shore in Galilee. There's nobody in sight. Quiet. Just a few pigs on a faraway hill, when suddenly out of the quiet comes running this crazy, scary man. Running right toward Jesus, he's shouting at Jesus, "Get out of here! Have you come to torment me?" Jesus immediately senses this man has a lot of inner demons. He commands them to come out of him. And did you hear the story? They didn't come out. Did you notice what Jesus did next? Mark 5, verse 9. Then Jesus asked the man, "What's your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." Note that word, "we." Ah, Jesus now knew these were the inner demons who were talking to him, revealing their name, Legion. You see, ancient people believed that when you learn someone's name, you gain a measure of power over them. You can now bless them or curse them by name. Ancient people believed that when you learned the name of a god, it now gave you a measure of power over that god, because you could now publicly invoke that god's name, and if the god didn't respond to your request, the god would be publicly shamed. So ancient people believed that names were critically important. And now, here in this gospel story, Jesus now has the name of the demon. He can now command them to come out by name. He does so, and they do. What lesson do you think we're supposed to learn from that for our lives today? How about this? The first step toward exercising your inner demons is to face them in the quiet, to look them in the eye, and to call them by name. "I know who you are. You're my fear of dying demon. I know who you are. You're my fear I'm unlovable demon." And each time we go toe to toe in the quiet with our inner demons and call them by name, they get weaker and weaker until they finally have to let go in the presence of the power of Christ within us. So don't be afraid of the dark. It can be an incredibly healing place. Don't be afraid of the quiet. It's where we find solace for our soul. If we want to thrive in life, we have to practice stillness. Where, how, when in your life are you practicing stillness? Mark Batterson, in his book, Whispers, reminds us that Susanna Wesley had 17 children, including her famous son, John Wesley. How does a mother of 17 living in a small house ever find stillness in her life? Susanna Wesley would put a rocking chair in the middle of the living room in their small house and literally cover herself with a blanket. And that would be her tent of meeting. That would be her place of stillness to encounter God and her inner demons and work through them. Thomas Edison had a thinking chair. Alexander Graham Bell had a dreaming place overlooking the Grand River. Henry David Thoreau had Walden Pond. Ludwig von Beethoven, every afternoon, he would go for a walk outdoors alone, carrying a pencil and a paper in his pocket for when genius would strike. Where is your whispering place? Where is your quiet place? Let me close with this. True story. Albert Samples was born to a mother who was a prostitute. Never knew his father. His father was just passing through. He lived with his mother for a number of years, and she treated him okay, except when she was drunk. She was drunk a lot, and when she was drunk, she was brutal. So at age 11, Albert Samples ran away. became a hobo traveling the train tracks during the Great Depression, learning violence as a way to survive. Eventually, he was arrested and convicted of assault and battery and sentenced to 28 years in Texas State Prison. 18 years into that sentence, he one day committed a minor infraction of prison rules and got thrown into solitary confinement, a dungeon. No light, just concrete walls and floor. 14 days into that experience of isolation, he began to have a panic attack. He imagined that water was trickling down the walls and going to fill up that dungeon and drown him. He threw himself on the floor and began pounding the concrete and shouting, "Help me! Help me!" And that's when it happened. He says, I heard this gentle voice of encouragement. And then this soft light shone all around me. And as I bathed in that soft light, within 30 seconds, he says, all of the violence was drained out of me. He says, I said to the voice, "What shall I tell them?" The voice said, "Tell them you met me here." And for Albert Samples, that was his tipping point. In the dark, in the silence, in the quiet, he came toe-to-toe, face-to-face with all his inner demons, and with the power of Christ beside him, he named them and he found healing. Our worst enemy is not out there. Our worst enemies are in here. Until we summon the courage to go toe-to-toe with our demons in the dark, we will never be free. Don't be afraid of the silence. It is a profoundly healing place. How? Where are you finding silence in your life?